fighters and commanders return right to the groups that they were fighting with and turn around and kill Afghan soldiers, Afghan civilians.
Afghanistan releases Taliban prisoners. It's Wednesday, June 12th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, unrest in the streets of Hong Kong. Chinese drones fight fires. Taxing big tech. China and Kenya talk trade. Finding Aussie gold and reaching for the stars. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The government in Afghanistan has unilaterally initiated a process of releasing hundreds of Taliban prisoners, a move being hailed by both the insurgent group and the United States amid a renewed push for finding a political settlement to the deadly Afghan war. Last week, President Ashraf Ghani had ordered nearly 900 prisoners to be freed within the next 2 months in a goodwill gesture. Officials asserted that most of the detainees are Taliban fighters, and dozens of them have since been set free. No official figures were immediately available, but Afghan media reports authorities would have released around 300 prisoners by the end of Tuesday. A Taliban statement confirmed its prisoners are being set free from different Afghan jails, calling it a positive step and urging the government to continue the process. U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan Johan Bas welcomed the releasing of insurgent prisoners by Kabul, saying it would improve the climate for a political settlement to the conflict. Lasting peace will be rooted in reconciliation and forgiveness by all, Bas tweeted on Tuesday. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke to an expert on the subject who does not agree. Bill Roggio is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense for Democracies in Washington. He says the prisoner release is a dangerous move.
Absolutely, this is dangerous. For one, they're putting Taliban fighters back on the streets, and when these prisoner releases happen, historically these fighters and commanders return right to the groups that they were fighting with and turn around and kill Afghan soldiers, Afghan civilians, and further the Afghan war, further the cause of the Taliban. So you're empowering your enemy, and this is being done unilaterally. So this is not, the Taliban aren't releasing Afghan soldiers, Afghan civilians that they hold. Believe it or not, they have prisons throughout the country. They're not being released. So it's a unilateral release, and it's not, they're not getting anything in return. So the Taliban are not going to give the Afghans what they want, which is to talk to them in peace and negotiation.
So here you are with the Afghan government, who the Taliban wouldn't even include in their talks a few months ago, releasing them for nothing. What happened?
I suspect there's a lot of pressure from Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. Special Representative for Peace in Afghanistan, from Resolute Support, which are really have put all their eggs in the peace basket. And, the U.S. and NATO has historically made numerous concessions to the Taliban in efforts to get them to talk. And the Taliban's message is very simple. First the U.S. withdraws, then they'll consider talking. Consider. Not they will, but they'll consider doing it. They demand the U.S. exit. So the U.S. believes that they can, and NATO believes that they can, they could cajole, they can convince the Taliban, that they can make demonstrations, they could placate them. The Taliban's having none of it. The Taliban really is just laughing at us as this is all going on.
And they're continuing their attacks.
Absolutely. There's been no let up. The Taliban claim to have overrun 6 districts over the last month. The U.S. will say, our strategy is to talk and fight. Well, the Taliban is really the one that is talking and fighting. They're using peace talks to extract concessions and to, I think, in my opinion, to delay the U.S. because they believe the U.S. is going to quit regardless. And they're fighting in the meantime to further their gains on the ground.
This does not sound like something that's coming out of the White House. It doesn't sound like a negotiating tactic from Donald Trump.
No, it doesn't. And you know, I think the White House, Calizade, and the U.S. State Department, which is leading this effort, have pretty much recognized that Trump at some point is very likely to pull the plug, that he doesn't want to deal with Afghanistan. So I think they're taking the lead on this and are doing everything they can in order to extract some type of agreement from the Taliban in order to, you know, trying to buy their, to use a Vietnam term, to buy their decent interval so that, you know, they can say, hey, we left Afghanistan in a good place and the Afghans blew it.
U.S. and Taliban negotiators are scheduled to hold another round of peace talks in Qatar later this month, but the dialogue process has failed to persuade the insurgents to cease hostilities and engage in intra-Afghan talks to find a lasting solution to the conflict. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. China accuses United States of interference over controversial Hong Kong extradition bill. China telecom giant Huawei hints U.S. pressure hurting sales. North Korea urges United States to change hostile policy on eve of summit anniversary. Bangladesh Prime Minister attacks Myanmar over Rohingya deadlock. Fighting fires with Chinese drones despite possible data theft. Expanded coverage of all these stories and much more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia and stop by our newly revamped voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hong Kong has witnessed the largest protest since the city was handed back to China from British control over a contentious bill that would allow extraditions to mainland China. A 1992 U.S. law known as the Hong Kong Policy Act recognizes Hong Kong separate from mainland China, including matters of trade and economics. VOA's Anna Cook spoke with Hong Kong expert Michael Davis, a global fellow at the Wilson Center, about how the extradition law, if passed, may affect the relationship between the United States, China, and Hong Kong.
It threatens to extradite people from Hong Kong to face criminal justice. And under the Hong Kong guarantees of, in the Sino-British Treaty and the Basic Law, Hong Kong is supposed to be a separate system. And the rights of Hong Kong people are to be protected under the Bill of Rights, which is really the international treaty. The other way that it threatens is less obvious to people, and that is what we have is a Hong Kong government that seems to be doing Beijing's bidding here. And this, unfortunately, has been the character of the Hong Kong government for many years, that it's generally seen in Hong Kong to represent Beijing more than to represent the people of Hong Kong, which under an autonomy arrangement should be the case. The Hong Kong people are also highly invested here. You know, mm-hmm. their livelihood, and, you know, and over the years, before the Sino-British Treaty was signed and before the Basic Law, there was a lot of immigration out of Hong Kong. If, in fact, the government in Hong Kong and Beijing, the governments, both governments, are tone deaf and not willing to listen to the concerns of Hong Kong, I fear that on the horizon we will see again immigration out of Hong Kong.
Why does the U.S. care about this?
The U.S. has 85,000 Americans in Hong Kong. That are there in all sorts of capacities, doing business and so on. And Hong Kong offers a kind of rule of law, open society venue for doing business in China. So those people in Hong Kong now are subject to the risk that they will be extradited. And this is not just an imaginary risk, because the Chinese approach to business is often involves when outsiders come and do business in a local area and China, that they can be harassed with prosecution and so on. And the second is, I think U.S. is just invested in Hong Kong generally, that basically the U.S. relationship with Hong Kong is separated from that with mainland China because of the promise of one country, two systems. So that is the premise for treating Hong Kong separately. When it comes to intellectual property, it treats Hong Kong distinctly as well. But now there was concern expressed in this congressional commission that intellectual property might be at risk in Hong Kong.
You know, in terms of doing business or in politics, how is the U.S.'s relationship different to Hong Kong than to China, and why is that important to sustain?
Well, it's very simple. I mean, China itself has orchestrated this through its one country, two systems policy. It was inviting countries to treat Hong Kong separately because Hong Kong has the rule of law. It's an open society. It has a free press. All of these kinds of things that the world's democracies have. And so they were told that they could rely on it. So that it's just absolutely different.
What does this mean or symbolize about how China is exerting its power beyond its borders?
Well, I think it does kind of send a signal, you know, basis for caution in dealing with China, that if China's presence grows strong, that it may assert, you know, its authority over those neighbors in ways they don't like. So there's a kind of nervousness in general about doing business with China. Well, if Hong Kong, the commitments to Hong Kong are undermined, because the Hong Kong commitments were at a much higher level, guaranteeing all of these, you know, free trade and rule of law and all of that. If that's undermined, I don't think it helps China's image at all across the region, especially in Southeast Asia.
Hong Kong expert Michael Davis speaking with VOA Asia's Anna Cook. Happening now in Asia news, Bangladesh Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina slammed Myanmar for delays in the repatriation of Rohingya refugees who fled violence in the neighboring country. Some 740,000 Rohingya took shelter in overcrowded camps in Bangladesh after Myanmar's military drove them over the border in 2017. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. DJI, the Chinese drone giant, sells drones to American police and fire departments. But a recent U.S. government warning said that Chinese-made drones may be stealing sensitive data. Michelle Quinn went to a fire department in Fremont, California, which has used DJI drones in more than 200 deployments over the past 2 years, about the advantages and risks of the technology.
The recent rescue of a deaf child in Fremont, California, was possible in part because of a drone's infrared camera that could see the child's body at night. This eye in the sky offers invaluable information to first responders, and it comes from DJI, a Chinese drone maker that dominates the market.
The drones have become an integral part of our day-to-day operations. We use them from everything from all of our fires with hazardous materials incidents to search and rescue.
But buying Chinese-made technology has become more fraught. Recently, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security repeated warnings that Chinese-made drones could transfer U.S. data back to China, accusations that DJI denies. For the Fremont Fire Department, the warnings serve as a reminder of best practices for storing and transferring information.
And so there are ways that we can localize our data so that it doesn't go out. You know, there's ways that we don't have to be connected to the internet. We don't have to transfer things over the internet. We can isolate our data within our system. And so we're confident with that.
About 1,000 U.S. public safety departments use drones, says Romeo Derscher with DJI. The company works with these agencies to train and prepare for disasters such as the wildfires in California. As the U.S. has raised concerns about drones, DJI has increased the kinds of security and data controls it offers its customers.
We are not in the business to control data, but we want to give the tools to the operator to say how the data is being stored or processed or transmitted. And those pieces are in place.
Drones are only going to become more important to the agency.
In the next 10 years, it will be as common as seeing fire hose on the back of the engine. You're going to have a drone in there because the intelligence gathered by a drone is, you know, irreplaceable now. It really has become an everyday tool.
An everyday technology that saves lives, but is also caught up in suspicions between two tech superpowers. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Fremont, California.
Coming up, big tech faces big taxes. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. a way to learn American English, and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia. North Korean state media called on the United States to withdraw its hostile policy toward Pyongyang, or agreements made at a landmark summit in Singapore a year ago might become a blank sheet of paper. The statement on state news agency KCNA echoed a similar warning last week. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for this and much more. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, scrutiny for big tech and new trade talk for China and Kenya are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
Global tech giants like Facebook, Google, and Amazon could face new taxes soon. At the recent G20 summit in Japan, finance ministers agreed to close the loopholes that allow these companies to avoid taxes by shifting profits to low-tax countries. Taro Aso is the finance minister of Japan.
We are facing a turning point. This could be the biggest reform of the long-established international framework in over 100 years.
Finance ministers discussed the possibility of a global minimum tax rate for digital services and a way to divide taxes where goods are sold, even in cases where a company does not have a physical presence in a country. Britain and France have been the most vocal supporters of taxing tech companies, often butting heads with the United States, which has argued that U.S. internet companies will be unfairly targeted. Officials are expected to meet again twice this year to work out the details of the so-called digital tax, with the goal of finalizing an agreement next year. China says it is ready to negotiate a new trade deal to address Kenya's concerns about a trade imbalance that favors China. Kenya imported goods worth $3.67 billion from China last year, while exporting just $112 million worth of goods to China. Nairobi wants to export more farm products, and government officials are pushing for duty-free access to the Chinese market. China's Kenyan ambassador, Wu Peng, says that developing the country's industrial base will go a long way towards addressing the trade imbalance.
Only through industrialization, Kenya can reduce the import and then have the capacity to export.
The Kenyan government has borrowed from China in recent years to build roads and railways. The projects are part of President Xi Jinping's Belt and Road Initiative, a $1 trillion investment plan that includes infrastructure projects throughout Asia, Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. Many have criticized these infrastructure projects for disproportionately benefiting China and creating an unhealthy dependency. James Shikwati is an economist at the Interregional Economic Network.
Without clear policies, obviously, then of course China can always bring their experts to fix things, and then they go away. And then when things go bad, again, we have to call the Chinese.
Beijing has consistently defended its motives, saying the Belt and Road investments will deepen ties and create new economic opportunities and markets. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news break from VOA Asia. China is accusing the United States of interfering in its internal affairs as opposition grows in Hong Kong over a controversial plan to allow people to be extradited to the mainland to face charges. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam is preparing to send the bill to the city's legislature for debate. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a fluffy pink fungus that decorates itself with gold nanoparticles has been found in Western Australia. Researchers believe the fungus is an indicator of gold deposits, and they hope the discovery will help miners narrow down where to dig. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Scientists in Australia have found a fungus that can bond with gold particles. It releases a chemical called superoxide that can dissolve gold in the soil. It's then able to mix this dissolved metal with another chemical to turn it back into solid gold in the form of tiny nanoparticles. So why does this gold-loving fungus have an attraction to this precious metal? The research team believes by interacting with gold in this way, it can grow faster and bigger relative to other fungi that don't. The research has been carried out by Australia's National Science Agency. The Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, the CSIRO, believes the discovery could be a new way to mine gold. The fungi could be markers that indicate the presence of gold and narrow down the area where exploratory drilling would be most beneficial. The study's author is Dr. Singh Bahu, a CSIRO geomicrobiologist.
I think this discovery is very novel because gold is very inert, generally speaking, but we found actually these fungus can interact with gold by dissolving gold. So I think it's very novel, and it's also very important for mining and other industry like leaching, so has some potential application.
The fungus was found in soil at Boddington, 130 kilometres southeast of Perth in Western Australia. The research has been published in the journal Nature Communications. Australia is the world's second largest producer of gold, and its output is expected to fall unless more deposits are discovered. In recent weeks, two Australians have stumbled upon large gold nuggets worth tens of thousands of dollars in Western Australia and the state of Victoria. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Anyone who ever dreamed of being an astronaut as a child, as an adult, has had to wait patiently to get the opportunity to see our brilliant planet from space. Now, in a surprise change, NASA has agreed to allow private citizens to spend time on the International Space Station. Great news, but VOA's Kevin Enix reminds us it won't be cheap.
During a very earthly press conference, NASA made some out-of-this-world news.
NASA is opening the International Space Station to commercial opportunities and marketing these opportunities as we've never done before. We're announcing the ability for private astronauts to visit the space station on U.S. vehicles, and for companies to engage in commercial profit-making activities on the station.
Sometime in 2020, NASA is expected to begin allowing two private astronauts a year to launch from Earth and spend about 30 days on board the ISS. It's going to save NASA plenty of money, but it's going to cost an aspiring astronaut millions.
When they get to station, there will be a cost for station, and if you look at the pricing and you add it up back of the napkin, it would be roughly about $35,000 a night per astronaut, but it won't come with any Hilton or Marriott points.
Beyond the price per night, any astronaut will have to pay Boeing and SpaceX, the two companies that provide rides to the ISS, and that could be even more money.
The ride to get there, as you know, right now, we pay about $80 million a seat for our own astronauts to go. If you average out the commercial crew program, our cost is coming down to about $58 million a seat. So theoretically, a private astronaut, I would expect the price to be in that range.
Anyone with the money and the inclination will also have to pass what will likely be some fairly rigorous medical tests. But NASA says letting private companies and people make their way into space will allow them to start looking even further into space.
It's showing that NASA is willing to let go and see if the private sector over time can take over low Earth orbit, and that's our vision moving forward.
Projects like putting humans back on the moon by 2024 and then Mars. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on the radio throughout Asia, especially if you stop by Thailand. Chiang Mai University Radio FM 100 at Chiang Mai University carries our program, and we thank everyone there for tuning in today. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Cedric Franklin, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We wish you a great day.